Chapter 151. Effect is given to the doll's dressmaker's discovery. Mrs. John Rokesmith sat at needlework in her neat little room, beside a basket of neat little articles of clothing, which presented so much of the appearance of being in the doll's dressmaker's way of business, that one might have supposed she was going to set up an opposition to Miss Wren. Whether the complete British family housewifehood imparted sage counsel anentum, did not appear, but probably not, as that cloudy oracle was nowhere visible. For certain, however, Mrs. John Rokesmith stitched at them with so dexterous a hand, that she must have taken lessons of somebody. Love is in all things a most wonderful teacher, and perhaps love, from a pictorial point of view, with nothing on but a thimble, had been teaching this branch of needlework to Mrs. John Rokesmith. It was near John's time for coming home, but as Mrs. John was desirous to finish a special triumph of her skill before dinner, she did not go out to meet him. Placidly, though rather consequentially smiling, she sat stitching away with a regular sound, like a sort of dimpled little charming Dresden china clock by the very best maker. A knock at the door, and a ring at the bell. Not John, or Bella would have flown out to meet him. Then who, if not John? Bella was asking herself the question, when that fluttering little fool of a servant fluttered in, saying, "Mr. Lightwood." ... Oh good gracious! Bella had but time to throw a handkerchief over the basket, when Mr. Lightwood made his bow. There was something amiss with Mr. Lightwood, for he was strangely grave and looked ill. With a brief reference to the happy time, when it had been his privilege, to know Mrs. Rokesmith as Miss Wilfer, Mr. Lightwood explained what was amiss with him, and why he came. He came bearing Lizzie Hexam's earnest hope that Mrs. John Rokesmith would see her married. Bella was so fluttered by the request, and by the short narrative he had feelingly given her, that there never was a more timely smelling bottle than John's knock. "My husband," said Bella, "I'll bring him in." But, that turned out to be more easily said than done. For, the instant she mentioned Mr. Lightwood's name, John stopped, with his hand upon the lock of the room door. "Come upstairs, my darling." Bella was amazed by the flush in his face, and by his sudden turning away. "What can it mean?" She thought, as she accompanied him upstairs. "Now, my life," said John, taking her on his knee, "tell me all about it." All very well to say, "tell me all about it." But John was very much confused. His attention evidently trailed off, now and then, even while Bella told him all about it. Yet she knew that he took a great interest in Lizzie and her fortunes. What could it mean? "You will come to this marriage with me, John dear?" "And no, my love, I can't do that." "You can't do that, John?" "No, my dear, it's quite out of the question. Not to be thought of." "Am I to go alone, John?"
"No, my dear, you will go with Mr. Lightwood."
"Don't you think it's time we went down to Mr. Lightwood, John dear?"
Bella insinuated.
"My darling, it's almost time you went, but I must ask you to excuse me to him altogether."
"You never mean, John dear, that you are not going to see him?"
"Why, he knows you have come home. I told him so."
"That's a little unfortunate, but it can't be helped."
"Unfortunate or fortunate, I positively cannot see him, my love."
Bella cast about in her mind what could be his reason for this unaccountable behavior, as she sat on his knee looking at him in astonishment and pouting a little. A weak reason presented itself.
"John dear, you never can be jealous of Mr. Lightwood?"
"Why, my precious child," returned her husband, laughing outright.
"How could I be jealous of him? Why should I be jealous of him?"
"Because, you know, John," pursued Bella, pouting a little more, though he did rather admire me once. It was not my fault. Apostrophe, it was your fault that I admired you. Apostrophe returned her husband, with a look of pride in her, and why not your fault that he admired you? But, I jealous on that account? Why, I must go distracted for life, if I turn jealous of everyone who used to find my wife beautiful and winning. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I am half angry with you, John dear, apostrophe said Bella, laughing a little, and half pleased with you, because you are such a stupid old fellow, and yet you say nice things, as if you meant them. Don't be mysterious, sir. What harm do you know of Mr. Lightwood? Apostrophe, none, my love. Apostrophe, what has he ever done to you, John? Apostrophe, apostrophe, he has never done anything to me, my dear. I know no more against him than I know against Mr. Rayburn. He has never done anything to me, neither has Mr. Rayburn. And yet I have exactly the same objection to both of them. Apostrophe, oh, John. Apostrophe, apostrophe, retorted Bella, as if she were giving him up for a bad job, as she used to give up herself. You are nothing better than a sphinx. And a married sphinx isn't a nice confidential husband, apostrophe said Bella, in a tone of injury. Bella, my life, apostrophe said John Rokesmith, touching her cheek, with a grave smile, as she cast down her eyes and pouted again. Look at me. I want to speak to you. Apostrophe, in earnest, Bluebeard of the secret chamber? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked Bella, clearing her pretty face. In earnest. And I confess to the secret chamber. Don't you remember that you asked me not to declare what I thought of your higher qualities until you had been tried? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, John dear. And I fully meant it, and I fully mean it. Apostrophe, the time will come, my darling, I am no prophet, but I say so, when you will be tried. The time will come, I think, when you will undergo a trial through which you will never pass quite triumphantly for me, unless you can put perfect faith in me. Apostrophe, then you may be sure of me, John dear, for I can put perfect faith in you, and I do, and I always, always will. Don't judge me by a little thing like this, John. In little things, I am a little thing myself, I always was. But in great things, I hope not. I don't mean to boast, John dear, but I hope not. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he was even better convinced of the truth of what she said than she was, as he felt her loving arms about him. If the Golden Dustman's riches had been his to stake, he would have staked them to the last farthing on the fidelity through good and evil of her affectionate and trusting heart. Now, I'll go down to, and go away with, Mr. Lightwood, apostrophe said Bella, springing up. You are the most creasing and tumbling clumsy boots of a packer, John, that ever was. But if you're quite good, and will promise never to do so any more, though I don't know what you have done, you may pack me a little back for a night, while I get my bonnet on. Apostrophe, he gaily complied, and she tied her dimpled chin up, and shook her head into her bonnet, and pulled out the bows of her bonnet strings, and got her gloves on, finger by finger, and finally got them on her little plump hands, and bade him goodbye and went down. Mr. Lightwood's impatience was much relieved when he found her dressed for departure. Mr. Rokesmith goes with us? Apostrophe, apostrophe, he said, hesitating, with a look towards the door. Oh, I forgot. Apostrophe, apostrophe, replied Bella. His best compliments. His face is swollen to the size of two faces, and he is to go to bed directly, poor fellow, to wait for the doctor, who is coming to lance him. Apostrophe, it is curious, apostrophe, observed Lightwood, that I have never yet seen Mr. Rokesmith, though we have been engaged in the same affairs. Apostrophe, really? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the unblushing Bella. I begin to think, apostrophe, observed Lightwood, that I never shall see him. Apostrophe, these things happen so oddly sometimes, apostrophe, said Bella with a steady countenance, that there seems a kind of fatality in them. But I am quite ready, Mr. Lightwood. " They started directly, in a little carriage, that Lightwood had brought with him from never-to-be-forgotten Greenwich. And from Greenwich they started directly for London, and in London they waited at a railway station until such time as the Reverend Frank Milvey, and Margaretta his wife, with whom Mortimer Lightwood had been already in conference, should come and join them. That worthy couple were delayed by a portentous old parishioner of the female gender, who was one of the plagues of their lives, and with whom they bore with most exemplary sweetness and good humor, notwithstanding her having an infection of absurdity about her, that communicated itself to everything with which, and everybody with whom, she came in contact. She was a member of the Reverend Frank's congregation, and made a point of distinguishing herself in that body, by conspicuously weeping at everything, however cheering, said by the Reverend Frank in his public ministration. Also by applying to herself the various lamentations of David, and complaining in a personally injured manner much in the rear of the clerk, and the rest of the respondents, that her enemies were digging pitfalls about her, and breaking her with rods of iron. Indeed, this old widow discharged herself of that portion of the morning and evening service, as if she were lodging a complaint on oath, and applying for a warrant before a magistrate. But this was not her most inconvenient characteristic, for that took the form of an impression, usually recurring in inclement weather, and at about daybreak, that she had something on her mind, and stood in immediate need of the Reverend Frank, to come and take it off. Many a time had that kind creature got up, and gone out to Mrs. Sprodgkin, such was the disciple's name, suppressing a strong sense of her comicality by his strong sense of duty, and perfectly knowing, that nothing but a cold would come of it. However, beyond themselves, the Reverend Frank Milvey and Mrs. Milvey seldom hinted that Mrs. Sprodgkin was hardly worth the trouble she gave. But both made the best of her, as they did of all their troubles. This very exacting member of the fold appeared to be endowed with a sixth sense, in regard of knowing when the Reverend Frank Milvey least desired her company, and with promptitude appearing in his little hall. Consequently, when the Reverend Frank had willingly engaged that he and his wife would accompany Lightwood back, he said, as a matter of course, "We must make haste to get out, Margaretta, my dear, or we shall be descended on by Mrs. Sprodgkin." " To which Mrs. Milvey replied, in her pleasantly emphatic way, "Oh yes, for she is such a marplot, Frank, and does worry so." " Words that were scarcely uttered, when their theme was announced as in faithful attendance below, desiring counsel on a spiritual matter. The points on which Mrs. Sprodgkin sought elucidation being seldom of a pressing nature as who begat whom, or some information concerning the Amorites, Mrs. Milvey on this special occasion resorted to the device of buying her off with a present of tea and sugar, and a loaf and butter. These gifts Mrs. Sprodgkin accepted, but still insisted on dutifully remaining in the hall, to curtsy to the Reverend Frank as he came forth. Who, incautiously saying in his genial manner, "Well, Sally, there you are," involved himself in a discursive address from Mrs. Sprodgkin, revolving around the result that she regarded tea and sugar in the light of myrrh and frankincense, and considered bread and butter identical with locusts and wild honey. Having communicated this edifying piece of information, Mrs. Sprodgkin was left still unadjourned in the hall, and Mr. and Mrs. Milvey hurried in a heated condition to the railway station. All of which is here recorded to the honor of that good Christian pair, representatives of hundreds of other good Christian pairs as conscientious and as useful, who merge the smallness of their work in its greatness, and feel in no danger of losing dignity when they adapt themselves to incomprehensible humbugs. Detained at the last moment by one who had a claim upon me, was the Reverend Frank's apology to Lightwood, taking no thought of himself. To which Mrs. Milvey added, taking thought for him, like the championing little wife she was, "Oh yes, detained at the last moment. But as to the claim, Frank, I must say that I do think you are overconsiderate sometimes, and allow that to be a little abused. Apostrophe, Bella felt conscious, in spite of her late pledge for herself, that her husband's absence would give disagreeable occasion for surprise to the Milveys. Nor could she appear quite at her ease when Mrs. Milvey asked, "How is Mr. Oaksmith, and is he gone before us, or does he follow us?" It becoming necessary, upon this, to send him to bed again, and hold him in waiting to be lanced again, Bella did it. But not half as well on the second occasion, as on the first, for, a twice-told white one seems, almost to become a black one, when you are not used to it, oh dear. Said Mrs. Milvey, "I am so sorry. Mr. Oaksmith took such an interest in Lizzie Hexham, when we were there before. And if we had only known of his face, we could have given him something that would have kept it down long enough for so short a purpose." By way of making the white one whiter, Bella hastened to stipulate that he was not in pain. Mrs. Milvey was so glad of it. "I don't know how it is," said Mrs. Milvey, "and I am sure you don't, Frank, but the clergy and their wives seem to cause swelled faces. Whenever I take notice of a child in the school, it seems to me as if its face swelled instantly. Frank never makes acquaintance with a new old woman, but she gets the face ache. And another thing is, we do make the poor children sniff so. I don't know how we do it, and I should be so glad not to, but the more we take notice of them, the more they sniff. Just as they do when the text is given out. Frank, that's a schoolmaster. I have seen him somewhere." The reference was to a young man of reserved appearance, in a coat and waistcoat of black, and pantaloons of pepper and salt. He had come into the office of the station, from its interior, in an unsettled Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.